the quill!
Today, I sit down with my friend and colleague, MIT Mechanical Engineering Professor Amos Winter, to talk about his adventures as an undergrad at Tufts University and his journey at MIT. I don't know many people who have ventured through the Australian outback on a motorcycle solo, developed a robotic clam, an all-terrain wheelchair, and award-winning desalination systems, irrigation systems, and prosthetic devices. Oh, and he races antique Porsches. Look at this. We've got Eggertown. Who the heck's on the vineyard listening to this? Concord, California, Odessa, Texas, Whitefield, New Hampshire, Portland, Connecticut. Portland, Connecticut? I didn't even know there was one.
I didn't even know there was one, yeah.
New Bedford, that's good, part of the fishing fleet.
What is here, here?
Zimbabwe.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. Capital city, of course.
Aha.
Here, we've got Saudi Arabia as well.
One down low.
Arlington, Boston, Somerville, Medford, it goes on and on. Massachusetts, it's okay, so it's heavily Massachusetts, it's heavily California.
Right.
But look at this, internationally. Australia, Switzerland, Portugal, France, Denmark, Spain,
Ireland,
Sweden,
yeah.
Netherlands.
Yeah,
Ghana.
Saudi Arabia, yeah. New Zealand, Germany.
So this isn't just Popolardo, like the provincial view of anything within 128.
No, this is worldwide.
This is global.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's the concept. Let me run this one by you.
Sure.
We will give a sticker to the farthest listener at the end of every month between now and commencement.
I like that.
All you need to do is email us your address, your mailing address. We'll look at who's farthest away at the end of the month, and then we'll send that person a sticker.
Just one sticker or?
Oh, we got to get into that again?
Oh, I did that to you last time.
You did. And I ended up giving Aditya a bunch of stickers.
How many stickers do we have?
I got a stack of them.
Oh, okay. All right. Last time we had...
No, I bought more.
Yeah, we didn't have a sticker to give away.
No. The department pitched in $60.
Did they? Oh, very nice.
Yeah. Got me 100 stickers. Now I'm going to up the stakes.
Okay. That sounds good.
Okay. We will then look at all of the winners between now and commencement. And the person who has been farthest away over that duration will get a Lock the Quill t-shirt.
Ah, nice. I'm all for that, yeah.
You're like, oh, that's
I'm
better.
Saying that's really nice because I don't even have a t-shirt yet.
No, I don't know. Nobody does.
No one does because we don't have a t-shirt
we
yet.
We don't have. Yeah, it's going to take us 6 months to make them. Send us your info.
Yeah, from far away.
LockTheQuill@mit.edu.
Lock the Quill.
Several weeks ago, I had a conversation with Pekka Hosoi. I don't know if you had the opportunity to listen to this conversation.
I have not listened to it.
As a graduate student, you acquired this lobster tank, right?
Yeah.
Okay, the lobster tank apparently was a little bit messy and it made a little bit of noise.
That's an, you're downplaying that, but yeah.
Okay, so it made a lot of a mess.
A lot of mess, a lot of noise.
Okay. Yeah. And so that may have upset a few people.
Yes.
You had indicated to me in one of our private moments together, this may have been a challenging period for some faculty in the lab. I know that Pekka may have discussed this with you. Is that correct?
Well, I think the way I put it is I think I'm the only student I know of that's been outright yelled at by Pekka.
Outright yelled at?
Yeah, because
that is hard to imagine.
Yeah, exactly. Because she got reamed out by Doug Hart because this tank was making such a mess and making so much noise. And the whole experimental area was such a mess around it, too.
I encourage you to listen to the conversation with Pekka because I did bring this topic up.
Yeah.
And Pekka actually took pause and said, you know, I don't remember this.
Well, it was pretty formative for me.
I can know,
understand.
But it was clearly impactful.
Yeah. It wasn't bad impactful. I understood where she was coming from.
Just in case you don't know where she was coming from, I thought I would invite Pekka Hosoi.
No way! Oh my god! Oh wow! It's been a while.
How you doing?
That's so funny.
I mean, right? There's hugs going on in here. Great podcasting. Very visual.
Man, it's been. I haven't seen Pekka in person in forever.
Forever.
No kidding.
To see you.
It's so. I
didn't know you were coming.
I I wasn't sure if Danny told you, so I was hiding in the doorway.
So,
that was so good.
So well staged.
So this was a short trip down memory lane. We had a 1950 Ralph Edwards This Is Your Life moment, but once I got the crowd settled down, we could focus on the business at hand. The lobster tank. It was just so funny because, yeah, you described the story. It was formative. You were scolded.
Do you remember this?
I honestly don't. Now that you're describing it, it's kind of triggering some things in my brain, but I don't.
I'll give you the background. Okay. So it wasn't right when we got the lobster tank. It was a little after that. And Dan Dorsch was working back there.
Yeah. Okay.
And it was just a pigsty. Yeah. Stuff was everywhere. Dan has had his stuff everywhere. He's like working on remote control planes and it was a total mess. And apparently Doug Hart came to you and said, Pecco, like, this is awful. Like, this is, my students can't work in this. And you conveyed to me that he yelled at you. And you said something to the effect of, like, if he's yelling at you, I'm yelling at you. And so
you kind of pass
that down. And you're so infrequently mad. You said something to the effect of, like, I'm actually mad and yelling at you. So take this seriously. And I was like, oh, geez, she's really mad at me. So I've said to a number of students, I think I hold the record as, like, the only student who actually got yelled at by you.
That's actually probably true. And you know the other amazing thing is, Doug is so laid back. Like, Doug would not notice a mess unless he was, like, wading through garbage when he was walking back there. That's hilarious. But, my brain is wired in a weird way that it remembers good things much more easily than bad things. Right. So if I get mad, my brain, you know, the next day my brain has filed that into the nope category and it's in some filing drawer that I'll never access again.
That's a signature strength. I love it.
I don't remember this as a bad thing, though.
Oh, okay. All right. No. That's even better.
No, even better. No. I have another. Can I tell another story?
Yeah.
I share this with students a lot still.
Yeah.
So we were working on a paper with Sonny Jung.
He's Sonny.
It was about... like the really fundamental mechanics theory about how razor clams dig.
Yep.
And Sonny had worked out this theoretical model, and I had a bunch of concerns because I felt the theoretical model didn't actually reflect what we were seeing in reality.
Yep.
And you sat me down and explained this to me, and I kind of nodded like, okay, I get it. This is a worthwhile thing. And then I was reviewing the paper a few weeks later, and I emailed you saying, I still don't get this. I don't get how this is a good contribution. And you literally wrote to me in an email.
Oh, jeez. Oh,
whack over the nose with a newspaper. Like you do with a misbehaving dog. I already explained this to you. So now you're going to explain it to me why this is a worthwhile thing to publish. And that was such a brilliant advising move. And you did it in a way where it wasn't demeaning at all. I didn't feel beaten down by it. I actually, in the moment, I remember feeling like, wow, this is a really good advising response, because it made me think deeply and then explain back to you why we should do this. And it was totally formative for me, because I think it gave me a much deeper appreciation for more fundamental research work.
Yeah.
So I tell students about this all the time.
This is
such a great moment.
This is why Amos and I work so well together.
We were
like the perfect match as the advisor-advisee combination.
Really?
He would push me to the breaking point, and it turns out that would be good for him.
Okay. I'll take that. It worked out, I guess, right?
It's great.
We're still here.
It's absolutely
still
great.
Friends.
Exactly.
I also like that we're going to have to get in contact with Dan Dorsch at this point.
Oh, absolutely. Oh,
yes.
Yeah. Now that you say it was Dan's junk back there, it all makes sense.
It was my junk too, but he really made it a pig stuff.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So we'll put it on Dan.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Yeah, really great. Anything else we want to air while I'm here with Amos?
Yeah,
I think you said you were going to take Amos to lunch and kind of clear this up. I don't know if that's still on the table.
Well, I'm always happy to take Amos to lunch.
Okay.
We're definitely going to go to lunch, but it turns out we don't need to clear the air because it seems like it was a good learning experience.
There was no bad feelings about this
that's
at all.
That's great.
Oh,
That's great.
Not at all. Exactly. These are good teaching moments. Perfect. Definitely.
See? See? Yeah, okay. That's why he's the perfect graduate student.
Now, her students around that era, we would joke that we should make t-shirts that say, what would Pecco do? You know, like, what would Jesus do? Because we'd always reflect. And I still think that way. Like, how would you handle this situation? What would Pecco do?
That's great. That's great. And do you have examples where you've actually done this in your advising, where you've had the what would Pecco do moment and go, you know what? I'm going to do this.
Yeah, I do it all the time.
That's so cool.
I do it all.
But, so great.
But I would say, too, you know, I think as an advisor, you try to take parts from other advisors you've had.
Yeah.
And then you figure out what is the best style for yourself.
That's true.
So why I think you were such a good advisor for me
is
because, like, you put it in my thesis defense, actually. You described being kind of like the bumpers when you go bowling with little
That's
kids.
That's exactly right.
And you just kind of nudge in the right direction. And then, you know, but I've got momentum and I'm running. And I love that analogy. And I think that worked really well for me. But I've found that I will be more assertive with students sometimes than you needed to be with me.
Yeah.
So it just depends. And every student's different.
Yeah. Too. Actually, every student is different. So I learned that style from you. Because I think when you first came in, I was sort of doing a more traditional advising style where I was saying, okay, try this, try this, try this. And you were the man with the plan. You had it all mapped out. You were going to do it. And so, I learned that you kind of had to, like you said, you had momentum. You got to let you run. If you run into something, you'll evaluate, reassess, adjust the plan. And it took me a while to learn that, but once I learned that, you were like the easiest student to advise. Hmm. It's like, oh, Amos is running. Okay, I'm going to put the bumper here. We'll see what happens when he runs into it, and then move on.
How often did you need to check in?
I honestly, not very much. So I would say, just like with any advising relationship, you have to kick in more frequently at the beginning of the PhD and then nothing at the end, mm-hmm. right? So it's a thing that ramps down. And that's kind of the sign of a successful PhD, that by the end, your student should be independent. So you're kind of, you're taking out more and more bumpers as you go along.
I'll give you one more ongoing Pecco advising story. I have said to my students that I feel like when you are an advisor, it's really a lifetime commitment. That you're always there as a sounding board or as a resource. And Pecco's absolutely been that way for me many times, where I'm just like, I don't really know how to deal with this. What's your advice, Pecco? And so many times gotten such sage advice. I really, really appreciate that.
Yeah, that's really nice to hear. Oh, yeah, and it's and it's absolutely true that I have, you know, I hear from almost all of my advisees periodically, like, We're everybody's busy. We might not interact for a number of years, but then, you know, if they run into something that's weird or something where they need to know, is this person reacting in a normal way in an academic setting? They'll shoot me an email or give me a call, and it's always I love those conversations. It's always great to catch up. It's always great to hear what people are doing. So. It's really nice. Like Amos said, it's a lifelong commitment. Honestly, as an advisor, I could not be more proud of Amos. It's so great to have him in the department. It's really great. And you remember on my podcast, I said that the hardest place for me to go give a talk was at the University of Chicago because it was like doing quals all over again. So what I'd like is for Amos never to feel that way in the department and for him to know that I totally view him as a colleague and not as a graduate student. So just want you to know that hopefully you're over that hurdle, and anything I can do to push that along, I'm there for you.
It's been a good decade, so I think I'm good with it.
Honestly, a decade. I'm not sure I'm over it yet.
Okay. From Chicago.
From Chicago. MIT, I'm fine. Chicago.
I have such fond memories of those years.
The lab was good. That was a great group. It was a really great group.
Advisors can clearly impact the lives and outlook of their students, but in Pecco's time of need, Amos helped shape the life of his mentor. He helped show her the way.
This was amazing. So I had surgery. So I told my group, I'm going to be out for like 3 weeks. I have not, you know, I'm not going to be able to do anything. I don't know how I'm going to survive 3 weeks because I'm going to be bored out of my skull. And Amos sends me this hard drive, which changed my life.
Yes, all the Top Gear episodes. And so she got super into Top Gear, and we talk about Top Gear all the time.
Yeah.
And I think do you still watch Grand Tour? And
I'm still watching Grand Tour. Although the older episodes are so hard
season
to beat.
Season 10.
Season 10, exactly. Yeah, season 10. I mean, you cannot beat season 10. Season 10 had the Africa episode, right?
24 hour race.
The bicycle, the Hammond on the bicycle. Yeah. I mean, that every episode in that is solid gold.
So to bring that full circle, when I started on the faculty, Pecco started interacting with the University of Loughborough on sports technology. So we went over to the UK together once on a trip and got to go to the Top Gear studio.
We did a pilgrimage to the Top Gear track.
The Holy Land.
It was incredible.
There's a photo that you have in some of your lectures. That's not from that period, is it?
Well, I think that photo's at McLaren. Because there's a great photo of us in the like foyer of McLaren,
which was like a James Bond villain. This was like it was like you walked into a volcano, and then it was inside it's all this gleaming white and chrome.
In Top Gear shots, you'll often see this DC-3 World War II plane on the airfield, and we helped push it off the tarmac.
That's right.
That was one of the things we had to do. They were like, "Can you guys help?" So we moved the plane around.
Yeah, that was really cool. That was super cool.
That was a fun trip.
And I tell you, seriously, this Top Gear, I was completely addicted to Top Gear after Amos sent this to me. Like, honestly, I think this got me through my recovery. I don't know what I would have done without this Top Gear. And it was hours and hours of it. It was so great.
It was literally every episode up until that point.
Yeah. And I think I still have that hard drive.
Nice.
I mean, it's just amazing. Like, yeah. So if anybody ever has surgery and you're stuck in bed, I recommend just download all of the old Top Gears. All right. Well, thank you guys.
Thanks for coming
thank
by.
Thank you.
Yeah,
I
of
love
course.
It.
Of
course.
This is really cool.
That was great,
what
Danny.
An awesome
I love the surprise.
It was good. It was
so
nice
good.
Timing back there.
All right, Amos. Well, enjoy your interview.
Thank you.
And I'll see you boys later.
All right.
See ya.
Yeah, I grew up in Southwest New Hampshire, outside of Keene, I in a town called Chesterfield, and then I went to Keene High School. So my hometown is 3,000 people, pretty rural, and had a great group of childhood friends in elementary school, and there's five of us who are still very close to each other, which is really cool, 30-something years later. And then I ended up going to Tufts for undergrad, and it was funny. I was pretty good at football in high school and was recruited a number of places and really wanted to play in the Ivy Leagues. But I was a little short for being an offensive lineman. I know.
Yeah. No kidding. You were considered short.
Yeah, I'm about 6'2", and you should really be about 6'4", 6'6". And so I had kind of put all my eggs in the basket of trying to go to Yale and was recruited by them. And it ended up not working out for a variety of reasons.
But were you also a science nerd engineer to be?
No, I wouldn't say. I was interested in that type of stuff. But I felt like in that era, to be competitive for colleges, you had to... you had to be a well-rounded student. You had to take the AP classes.
Sure.
You had to do sports and activities and stuff. So I think if I had to do high school over again, I would do first robotics and things like that. But I wasn't into that. But I certainly liked mechanical things and building things. In high school, I would say the most formative experience was I did a summer program at the St. Paul's School called the Advanced Studies Program. St. Paul's is a private school in Concord, New Hampshire. And for the last... I think nearly 70 years, they've invited public school, high school kids to come for 5 weeks and study a course that's usually not offered in a public high school, and as well as take a writing class that's really geared towards college essay writing. So I was luckily admitted into that and got to participate in it. And it was transformative. It remains, I would say, the most intellectually stimulating and growth periods of my life. So I got to totally geek out and I ended up doing a class called the Physics of Sound and Music, where you study the physics behind music and musical instruments. And I ended up building a little pipe organ. so I made a one octave major scale pipe organ that ran off a vacuum cleaner running backwards, you know, blowing air through it. And it had an actual stop and the flap valves and everything that makes a pipe organ work. And what really inspired me to do that is St. Paul's has the largest pipe organ in the state of New Hampshire. It's a 6,000 pipe organ.
No kidding.
And it's a, you know, mechanical, electromechanical wonder.
Yeah,
you can actually go inside it and experience this.
Do you stay in contact with any of the people associated with that program?
Yeah, I try to go back every year. And a good friend of mine who taught a course there for many years would bring his class down here in the mm-hmm. summer. And so I'd show them around and talk with them. And then I would usually go up there every summer too and talk about what I do and talk about engineering schools and what they may want to consider.
Sure.
Because I feel like a lot of those students don't get great guidance counselor advice about trying to be an engineer.
Yeah, sure.
You know, it's if you want to look at good engineering schools, that's different than the good U.S. News ranked schools
mm-hmm.
sometimes. What I see a lot is a kid from New Hampshire is probably not aware of a school like Purdue,
mm-hmm.
right? Never been talked about, doesn't realize that they're probably going to get in because there's not a lot of New Hampshire students applying there.
Right, sure.
And it's, you know, one of the top, at least mechanical engineering programs, but really for most engineering is going to be one of the top programs. So it's things like that we'll talk about. And I think that summer experience at St. Paul's is what primed me intellectually for going into college and having a good experience.
In addition to being an accomplished scholar in high school, Amos was a sought-after football player and was looking to play in the Ivy Leagues. But at only 6'2", I can't believe I'm saying that, he placed his defensive line activities at Tufts University, right on the border of Somerville and Medford. It was at Tufts where Amos made an important connection.
The really fulfilling intellectual part of college was working with a guy named Chris Rogers, who's still a professor at Tufts. And his claim to fame is he built all the code for the Lego Mindstorms robotics kits and was sponsored by Lego to do that. So he had this whole Lego lab when I was there. And so I would help him build educational demos to demonstrate engineering concepts with Legos, and then also did outreach at local area schools. We went to Lincoln and we went to Malden, and then I did some in New Zealand as well. I did a semester abroad in New Zealand with him.
And you use Legos now for 007.
Sometimes, yeah. Yeah, I still like Legos.
Yeah,
for sure.
We have a bin of Legos in the back. The financial office called us and asked, why are you buying Legos?
Oh, come on. Why not? I'd say in college what happened is it was really in college where I started getting super excited about building stuff as an engineer and designing stuff. And I attribute a lot of that to Chris. I took actually an engineering of musical instruments class with Chris and ended up building this like way overcomplicated piano type thing. It was actually a good lesson in ambition exceeding resources uh-huh. and time and abilities. But Chris was kind of easy on me and not docking me too much in my grade. But I got to do that. And these experiences in the machine shop led up to my senior year, like living in the machine shop.
Mm-hmm.
Every day I was in there for multiple hours because I built a battle bot as my senior thesis.
Mm-hmm.
So really,
did you participate in that as a competition?
The competition actually got canceled that year.
Uh-huh.
It went off the air for a number of years. And so I didn't end up getting to compete with it,
but you designed and finished it.
Yeah, yeah. I still have it. It's titanium skinned and, really, really cool piece of hardware. But also what I credit Chris for is, he also got me into applied engineering work by first setting me up with MBARI, which is the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, which runs a wonderful intern program. So I went out there as an intern after my sophomore year. And I ended up, for my project that summer, making a Lego model of one of their big remotely operated vehicles, big underwater robots, to ideally sell in the gift shop at the Monterey Bay Aquarium just to get kids excited about underwater engineering.
Am I correct in saying that that's where you met Mark Jeanette?
That is correct. Mark Jeanette and I were interns at Ambari the same summer and were roommates.
And Mark Jeanette commented that you stayed up all night to put together this big presentation.
Yeah,
do you remember
like
that presentation?
Oh, yeah.
He said that you animated every single slide.
Yeah, I did. I went, that was kind of my awakening in terms of PowerPoint animations, and I way overdid it.
Do you still have this presentation?
I remember people saying after, they were being nice, like, oh boy, if I have to make a PowerPoint, I'm coming to you to animate it. You know, I was a sophomore, you know, going into my junior year of college.
I get it. Yeah. I'm not bashing it. I think it's awesome.
But it went well, like, that was a wonderful experience, and I've maintained contact with those folks.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was 21 years ago. My junior year, Chris decided to do a sabbatical in New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked to a bunch of us mechanical engineers and said, you should come with me. Go do a semester abroad. Mm-hmm. And it was hard at that point. Like, people at Tufts didn't typically do that.
Mm.
But he helped work with the administration to make sure we got credit for the classes we did there. And so, God, about 8 or 10 of us ended up going to Christchurch to the University of Canterbury. And it was that was another transformative experience for me in a lot of ways. So it was the first time I had lived outside of the country, which was really, really fun. It's also where I bought a motorcycle.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up touring all around New Zealand and then shipped it to Australia and ended up doing a lap of the whole eastern half of Australia. Yeah. Right up through the outback.
And was that during the school break?
Yeah, it was. So we had a 4-week Easter break in that spring semester. And I basically took 2 additional weeks to do that huge trip. It was one of those moments. I had a teacher in high school who used to say, don't let school interfere with your education. And that was one of those moments where that time in Australia and New Zealand, touring around and exploring as an individual was so powerful for me. And I think that's when I started really enjoying both traveling around the world and also doing it with cool vehicles.
So Chris Rogers was very influential then.
Oh yeah, I love the guy. He's very much a father figure and still is. You know, mm-hmm. We're still really close.
We should all be so lucky to have had mentors such as Amos had. So in keeping with the This Is Your Life vibe for this episode, seems like I've got a phone call to make.
Hello?
Hello, Chris?
Yeah.
Yeah, hi, this is Danny Bronstein from MIT. How are you?
I'm doing well, I figured. How about yourself?
I'm doing great.
So what do you want to know about him?
Just paint a picture of what Amos was like as a young undergraduate.
Sure.
He says so much of what he does now, he attributes to the time he spent with you.
Well, he was a big guy. No, he's super nice, super enthusiastic. He took a bunch of classes with me and worked a lot at the center on all sorts of different projects. So the center is a place that we work with teachers and kids in schools about bringing engineering into classrooms.
Mm-hmm.
So it's K-12 predominantly. I remember one of the first things he built on his own was a Lego 4-wheel drive vehicle with 4 separate motors that was pretty neat. That could drive over just about anything. And clearly a great combination of his love for robotics and his love for cars.
Yeah, well, the Unimog that he currently has drives over everything.
But it uses gas, so I don't know. It doesn't seem to me like it's really a worthwhile vehicle.
I see. So he needs to do an electric conversion of the, or at least a hybrid of the performance cars.
Well, I mean, don't you want some startup torque? I mean, come on. Why have a car if you only have a couple hundred horse? It's not fun.
What do you remember most about Amos?
Well, we used to work out together in New Zealand. That was fun. a lot of Frisbee. Mostly just his enthusiasm and excitement. He's just a lot of fun to do work with, as you well know. And then, yeah, kept in touch with him ever since.
he talks about the Ambari trip being very influential.
Yeah, that was a neat summer program that he did that actually that got us into a whole bunch of different Lego-based underwater robots, which was fun. I don't know if he showed you the picture of he made, I think it was Alvin, he made out of Lego. could drive it around. It was really pretty cool.
Was this the kit that he wanted to sell in the gift shop?
Yeah, probably. That sounds about right.
Everything that he seems to have done in his career now, I can, you know, there's a direct line to some of the work that he did with you, and certainly at Mbari, and the Australia trip and New Zealand trip was just huge, hugely influential.
It was a lot of fun having him. I'm not sure everything has a direct line back. Yeah, sure. And then we'll figure out a way to bring it back to his freshman course. It all started freshman year.
You were at the epicenter of this guy's, you know, whole professional path.
That would be nice, but I think that might be a bit strong. I think he was pretty much geared for success. His only Achilles heel are his knees. That would shut him down all the time. Football really messes your body up. So I should have, what I should have done was given you more dirt then on Amos. Come on.
Oh, you could give me dirt.
I don't know. He's still bigger than I am. And he still lifts. So, you know, I might get hurt.
Well, he admitted yesterday that he heals a lot slower than he used to. But he still is 6'2", so I understand where you're coming from.
And he weighs a little bit more than I do, too.
All right. Thanks, Chris. I'll talk to you later.
All right, Danny. Nice talking to you. See you.
Bye now. After the New Zealand adventure, Amos interned at JPL, working on the Mars Explorer program and also at Bluefin Robotics, where he continued to develop his love with underwater exploration and machines in extreme environments. Amos commented, "I learn more through internships than anything at school." After graduating Tufts, Amos applied for a Fulbright scholarship to work on underwater robotics in Scotland, but was declined. Always forward-thinking, though, Amos had a fallback plan. Yep, MIT was his safety school. Oh, geez. He received his master's degree with Professor Marty Culpepper, where he developed a new construction method for fluid film bearings, but the call of the sea beckoned. The sailor, Bernard Moitessé, said, "You do not ask a tame seagull why it needs to disappear from time to time toward the open sea. It goes, that's all. And it is as simple as a ray of sunshine, as normal as the blue of the sky." So Amos knocked on Petco's door. Ended up back with underwater robotics and exploration by connecting with Petco.
Yeah, so this is another good Petco story. So I was friends with a number of her students, and I really liked the type of like bio-inspired robotic stuff she had been doing, like the RoboSnail. And so I met with her and talked with her. In typical Petco fashion, she was like, "I'd be happy to hire you and bring you into my group if you bring your own money." Okay. So that made me go back to Bluefin and Battelle and start, you know, rattling my tin cup to say,
"No kidding.
You know, would you guys fund my PhD? And could we find a project focus that overlapped with Petco's area of expertise and your interests?" The hero of that story actually is a guy named Rob Carnes, who's another father figure, another really close person in my life, who was the head of all R&D at Battelle, who got to know me and basically said, "We are funding this guy. I want to support Amos. I believe in him." And he has been a wonderful supporter, you know, through the last few decades. Just great catalyst to get things going. So anyway, we put together the scope of a project for a PhD, which was focused on underwater digging. And the application was that Bluefin had situations where they'd want to put vehicles in places where there's a current, but they didn't want to have to continually have to fight against the current with their propellers, because then you just blow all your energy. So the idea was, what if you could send down a little anchor that goes into the ocean bottom, it digs itself in and sets itself, and then can also dig itself out and retract? And so Petco liked this idea of underwater burrowing. It was like this unique animal locomotion that we could try to figure out. And Bluefin liked the application, so that's what started the RoboClam project. In the beginning of the PhD, I surveyed really every organism that digs into or clings to or sticks to the ocean bottom to see where was their good inspiration for an anchor.
What do you recall some of the other animals?
Oh, limpets that stick to rocks really well. Kelp, which I think kelp, but some underwater plants develop these root type things called holdfasts that get into the cracks of a rock and can hold on really, really, really well. And what stood out from that survey was razor clams, because one, they dig incredibly quickly. They dig at about a centimeter per second. Two, they live in a very wide range of substrates, all the way from pretty big particles like sand, all the way down to pretty small particles like silt, getting close to clay. Variants of those, not razor clams themselves, but other mollusks, can dig through rock and wood. So, yeah, as a sailor, shipworms, right, is actually a clam. And there's also rock-boring mollusks, too, that can dig through rock. And then the other thing that stood out is there was a guy, I'm forgetting the name of the researcher, but decades ago, figured out enough of the forces and pressures happening in the clam to actually figure out the energy it's using to dig. And what was astounding about that is these animals, which are pretty big, they're about 8 inches long and about an inch and a half wide, they can take that hard shell and go over a half kilometer on the energy in a AA battery. So not only do they dig quickly, but they dig incredibly efficiently somehow. And what was also baffling is if you look at the amount of strength the clam has to pull its shell downwards, because it what it does is it inflates its foot, which is like a tongue-like structure, like a balloon, and then pulls on that to pull its shell downwards. The animal should only be strong enough to go a few centimeters into the soil, but somehow they dig on the order of a meter deep. So somehow they're manipulating the drag of the substrate on their body. And so this prompted a really interesting biological science question of like, how the heck do they do this?
Yeah, sure.
And so the first contribution out of my PhD was explaining how that happens. And so I ended up building like an ant farm for razor clams. So it was this clear pane glass thing filled with clear glass particles that were about a millimeter in diameter. And I had randomly entrained opaque particles too, that I could use with particle image velocimetry and actually track their movement as the animals dug.
Oh, that's fun.
And what I was able to measure as they were digging is that they quickly collapse their shell. They close it very fast to suck water towards their shell. That sucking of water moves particles towards their shell, and they actually locally unpack the soil right around their shell to create this little pocket of quicksand. They fluidize the substrate just locally,
just in the perimeter,
and just for that split second to fluidize, move downwards, and then re-expand.
How, just curious, how large is this boundary layer or area?
Oh, it's
relative to their 1 inch diameter.
You know, it's less than an inch. It's less than one body width. Yeah, it's but within that one body width zone is where it's happening. It's a really, really small effect. And so the next contribution was describing the mechanics of how this happens, because what you're doing is unpacking the soil particles locally. And you can't explain it with fluid mechanics alone. You can't explain it with solid mechanics alone. But if you add in soil mechanics and how soils behave, which are different than solids and fluids, you bring all those three areas of mechanics together, you can describe how this localized fluidized effect happens. So we were able to predict the characteristic time scale that you need to contract in order to locally fluidize. Because if you do it too fast, you end up cavitating, right? You won't move the water, or you don't give the soil particles enough time to actually move.
Right.
If you do it too slowly, what happens is the soil just settles and like landslides and packs in around the clam. So there's a sweet spot, time scale, which depends on the soil type and the clam size and all this stuff. So we predicted that characteristic time scale, and sure enough, the animal does it.
No kidding.
Yeah. And we were able to use all that to design a machine that mimics the clam's motion. And we had that machine, and this was the RoboClam machine. We had it dig both in these like idealized soil particles, which were glass beads, but I also took it out to real razor clam habitat in Gloucester on the mudflats there. And we were also able to show with that machine that that sweet spot time scale is the one that made it dig most effectively. And we were able to show that machine was able to achieve localized fluidization because of how digging energy scaled with depth. Now, all these insights didn't happen in this order, actually.
Sure,
I made the ant
sure.
farm first, then the RoboClam, and made the RoboClam actually ran with a genetic algorithm to randomly select its digging parameters, like how much force, how fast it moved. And it would evolve with that genetic algorithm to the most low energy digging method which turned out to be that sweet spot.
The sweet spot for that particular soil condition, too.
Yeah.
So that suggests that, say, a razor clam in silt versus mud versus sand would behave a little bit differently.
Yep. Or in dry soil.
Or in dry soil.
Yeah, and that was actually a project we took on after to see, like, how fast would you have to contract to move particles in dry soil, and it's a lot faster. So it was a wonderful PhD.
Sounds great.
I was a licensed clam digger in the state of Massachusetts.
As we all should be.
As we all should be. You might know this, but your listeners may not, but every town on the seacoast in Mass has what's called a shellfish constable.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's the actual term.
Oh, yeah.
And they monitor the harvesting of the mollusks because poaching can be a big issue. So I got to be good friends with a guy in Gloucester because there's a really good mudflat for clamming up there. And I'd call him up and say, is it okay to come up? Because you don't want to harvest after a rainstorm because the clams like ingest all the runoff from the roads and stuff. So yeah, as part of my PhD, I'd have to go to Gloucester, dig up razor clams, bring them back, put them in the lobster tank that we mentioned earlier with Pecco.
Yeah.
The reason I got that, so at the beginning of my PhD, I think in the first year, I had a materials and services budget of like $3,000.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to test animals. I wanted to see how razor clams dug. And I called around to aquatic animal supply centers and stuff like that. And they said, hey, the best tank you can get to keep these things in is a commercial lobster tank because it oxygenates and chills the water for you. And they said, you should call around to supermarkets to see if they've stopped selling lobster and they may have a tank available.
Mm-hmm.
So I called all the Boston area supermarkets and it turned out one of the Whole Foods in Boston had just decided to stop selling lobsters because of the ethical considerations of putting lobsters in boiling water, right?
Mm-hmm.
They said, we don't want to do this anymore. So they had this great lobster tank available. So I ended up buying it from them for like a grand. Actually, John Hart, who's a professor in our department, he helped me move it from Boston in a U-Haul truck to MIT. They helped me load it and unload it up and down the ramp and stuff. So I set it up in Pecco's lab, and it was outrageously noisy. So I went over to the Edgerton Center and talked to Jim Bales about how to isolate sound. And ended up lining the interior of that tank with drywall for a really high density material to help reduce the sound emission. Mm. But then I had to add in all sorts of cooling fans because it restricted the airflow. So it was always dicey because like if a cooling fan went down, the temperature in the tank would spike and it would kill all the animals.
Oh.
So that was always a funny balancing act. But that's how I got the tank reasonable to sit next to for Doug Hart students who had to sit next to it in the back room of the fluids lab. It was fun. It was fun being scrappy like that.
Yeah, I agree.
While a grad student, Amos also got interested in wheelchair design. And by the way, this work was while doing his research in underwater anchoring. And it became a research launching point once Amos received his PhD and stayed at MIT as junior faculty. He started by developing a bit of a graduate-level analog to the undergraduate program of Amy Smith's D-Lab.
Now, on the side, while I was a graduate student, I ended up getting really interested in wheelchairs for developing countries. And the way this transpired is that after my master's, my girlfriend at the time was living in Tanzania.
Mm-hmm.
And in that summer between master's and starting a PhD, I really wanted to go be with her. And I never traveled to a developing country at that time. And I ended up getting hooked up with Amy Smith, who started D-Lab and the MIT Public Service Center. And through their network, found this wheelchair organization in San Francisco called Whirlwind that designed wheelchairs for developing countries, as well as an organization in Tanzania called TATCOT that taught people how to make wheelchairs so they could set up their own workshops and provide wheelchairs to that country. And so both Whirlwind and TATCOT said, boy, we'd like some feedback on what the current state of the market is, how well products are meeting people's needs, how well our products are doing, et cetera. So with the Public Service Center, put together this project where I spent the summer talking to wheelchair users, wheelchair manufacturers, and disability advocacy groups, just getting a sense of what does the market look like. And I came away from that summer realizing that particularly rural areas of developing countries, not only Tanzania, but this was true worldwide, were very much underserved because there wasn't a device that could both go long distances fast and efficiently on rough terrain if you want to go from your like village home to your school, but also be small enough to use indoors and also be cheap enough to fit within the provision methods there. And I came back from that feeling like, hey, I'm being trained as a machine design engineer. I have a pretty good skill set to tackle this. Why don't I go after it? And that started this really wonderful experience over the following years where we developed what became the Leverage Freedom Chair, or LFC, wheelchair. And so what's unique about this chair is that it has a lever-propelled drivetrain where you grasp these two levers with your hands, and you can slide your hand position up and down the levers to change your mechanical advantage. So if you have to go through mud or something, you grab high on the lever and get a long lever length, produce a lot of torque to the wheel. If you want to go fast, you grab down near the pivots of the levers, which are under the seat, and you can push through a big angle every stroke and go at about 5 miles an hour, like faster than walking speed. And so all of this is made with bike parts. It's a really low-cost product. You can make it anywhere. And through my years of grad school, every summer and every IAP in January, Independent Activities Period, we were building and testing prototypes all over the place. So we did our first field trials in East Africa, in Tanzania, Kenya, and Uganda. Then we moved on to Guatemala. And then after I finished my doctorate, we did the last field pilot and transitioned into a company in India. So that was an awesome experience. And how that comes to what I do now is I looked at these two very formative experiences in my PhD of doing the RoboClam project, which was cool engineering science designing for highly constrained environments. And then I had this wheelchair project, which was very challenging engineering, also in highly constrained environments. And I realized, well, why not create a research group that applies hardcore engineering science to developing world technology problems? And there's no shortage of needs to do this. And what's funny, a funny aside actually, is as I was graduating and thinking about applying to faculty jobs, I had numerous people tell me, don't focus your research on that. You'll never get tenure. Because it's viewed as like junior varsity engineering, you know, undergrads cobble together widgets, know, and it doesn't look like, you know, real rigorous engineering, and there's nothing to be learned from it. You know, they'll eventually just adopt what we use in rich countries. And I heard that and I was like, you guys are totally missing the boat here, right? Like, you know, how can you look at a situation where you have literally millions of people often facing life or death challenges that are technical in nature and remains unsolved decade after decade after decade. What a wonderful space to play in as a researcher, right? Very much in the Louis Pasteur sense. Louis Pasteur is totally one of my heroes because he was able to do amazing science on like vaccines and understanding pasteurization, but had that eye towards practical utility and impact on the real world. And literally, you know, how many millions of people are saved every day from getting sick off poisoned milk, you know, because of pasteurization. So that's that convergence of the experience with the wheelchairs and the experience on RoboClam came together with the pitch I gave to our department. And I said, look, students want to do this stuff for their graduate degrees. We have, you know, four at the time, it was like 400 students a year going through D-Labs classes, which are undergrad focused. There's no grad opportunities for
I see. Is there a primary funder for that? What's the main channel?
My group gets a real big mix. And what it really comes down to is matching value propositions. So USAID is one of our big funders, the U.S. Agency for International Development. What they care about is making a positive impact in developing countries and showing that U.S. tax dollars led to that. So our pitch has to be built on that. How can we save people water, help them grow more crops, convert salty water into fresh water, right? So we have to articulate that vision for impact. I can't do just like a blue sky, I want to study underwater basket weaving and have USAID fund it, right? It has to be applied. We also get a lot of money from companies, and companies will look at developing and emerging markets as huge growth opportunities, right? Because there's literally, in some cases, billions of people who are non-consumers now, but could be customers mm-hmm. in the future. So like the work that we do on drip irrigation very much falls into that, that there's a huge for-profit opportunity there. Farmers buy irrigation equipment.
Sure.
And there's a huge population that could use drip irrigation, save water, grow more crops, make more money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all these value propositions line up both for the customer and the company, the mm-hmm. sponsor. And then philanthropic money, too, is also a big part of our portfolio right now in that philanthropies want to support the aims of what we're doing. We're trying to make a positive impact on people's lives, but do it in a economically sustainable model where ideally the technology is scaled through free market mechanisms, which ensures that it scales up and is sustained because somebody's incentivized to do it. So to put it this way, let's say you have a $1,000 irrigation system,
yeah.
which is not that expensive mm-hmm. for an irrigation system, and you want to impact 1 million farmers, which is just a sliver of the market size. If you want to give that technology away, that's $1 billion charitable proposition, right?
Yeah.
Unless your name ends with Gates,
yeah,
it's not
sure.
going to happen, right?
No, it's...
But yeah. if you think of it now as $1 billion of revenue for an agriculture company...
There's an opportunity right there.
There's plenty of agriculture companies that are multi-billion yeah, year sure. in revenue. Yeah.
I know you were recognized by USAID in 2015 for your desalination work. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's when we won the Desal Prize.
That was there was some work you did with the battery charging, PV efficiency. I forget exactly.
Yeah, we still do a lot of work on this. So it's focused on solar-powered desalination
mm-hmm.
of brackish groundwater.
Yeah,
and just
sure.
to put this into context globally, I would say the vast majority of the desalination community is really focused on large-scale plants that do seawater desalination.
Sure.
Right? So that's really only impacting coastal communities and ones that can afford big right. infrastructure.
Right. Most of the water, groundwater, is brackish, no?
Yeah. Yes. As you go throughout the world, if you just randomly drill a well, you're more likely to hit brackish water than freshwater.
Yeah.
And also, more than half the world's population is going to live
farther from the coast.
Yeah. It's like more than 100 kilometers or something.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
there's this massive, massive, massive market for... Can you convert that brackish water that's otherwise useless to something useful in mm-hmm. terms of fresh groundwater by desalinating it? Energetically, it takes a lot less energy to take the salt out of brackish water,
sure.
which is about 10 times less salty than seawater, but it's still too salty to drink.
Mm-hmm.
And then where we have focused in particular is doing solar-powered desalination for communities that may not have grid access
yeah.
or have unreliable grid access. And our initial focus market was India, and you know, you're talking about hundreds of millions of people that fall into that demographic, like small village, intermittent or no grid access, and have brackish groundwater.
How many people are doing research in the brackish groundwater as opposed to the coastal seawater desalination?
Brackish groundwater desalination is definitely a field.
Like mm-hmm.
I can't give you an exact number, but it's multiple people. It's just as far as like the overall pie of desalination
yeah.
research, the bigger proportion, the majority is focused on seawater for sure. The big things that we've done is that from the get-go, we realized that instead of using reverse osmosis, which is the industry standard mm-hmm. for any type of desalination, we realized that electrodialysis, which is a means of electrically pulling the salt out of the water,
mm-hmm.
Has a number of merits in a brackish water situation. So one, for the salinities that you find in brackish water, you need about half the energy to take the salt out versus what you would need for reverse osmosis.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to make a solar-powered system, you need half the panel area, half
sure.
the power system size. The second big merit is that electrodialysis can... minimize your wastage significantly compared to reverse osmosis.
Mm-hmm.
So we our systems will run at around 10% wastage, whereas small community scale reverse osmosis systems usually run at about 60% wastage.
No kidding.
And why that's important is for two reasons. One, if you're talking about brackish groundwater, it's a more finite resource because you don't want to overdraw that aquifer
mm-hmm.
too quickly. And then the second is you have to deal with the brine somehow.
Yeah, right.
Right? So making less brine makes it easier to deal with. The default solution would be you put it into a pond, evaporate off the rest of the water, and collect
sure.
the salt as a waste. So we saw that opportunity for electrodialysis. However, electrodialysis is wickedly expensive compared to reverse osmosis because it doesn't have the market scale.
Mm.
It's not commoditized like reverse osmosis. Mm. So what we've done over the last decade is figured out a bunch of tricks largely around the system design and operation to make electrodialysis a lot cheaper, particularly mm-hmm. with solar power. So our newest systems are pretty cool in how they work, in that electrodialysis actually is very amenable to running at different power levels versus reverse osmosis, which is really best at running at a certain flow rate and pressure. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. With electrodialysis, we can actually vary our flow of water through mm-hmm, the system, mm-hmm. which varies our rate at which we will extract the salt. And we actually have two variables then that we can manipulate: the electrical power, which to take out salt, and the pumping flow rate. Mm-hmm. And by varying both of those variables, we can make the system change its power consumption in sync with variations in the sun's power.
Okay.
And so our current systems are on the order of a kilowatt system as far as the power it uses, and it uses a single DeWalt drill battery as an energy buffer. Buffering on the order of tens of watts, just because there's a kind of a transient response lag between the pumps spinning up and slowing down and stuff. So we're able to make these direct drive solar powered systems that are cranking out water all day long, which is super cool. And what we're projecting right now is that if you're looking at an on-grid reverse osmosis system, which is the industry standard, versus one of our solar powered electrodialysis systems, yeah. we are hitting price parity in terms of cost per unit volume of water.
Okay.
And now our capital cost is higher because we got more equipment, we got the solar power sure. and all this stuff. But where we save cost is the recurring costs of the energy costs. And if you add in water or brine treatment costs or the cost of the input water,
sure.
we get even more competitive. Sure.
And if you add in a carbon tax, that might be on the horizon, be even more compelling.
Yep.
Now, is this a system that's hanging up over at the sailing pavilion?
No, that was, I can talk about that. The system I just referred to is actually running in New Mexico right okay. now. And in the next year, we're going to set up three variants of it in the American Southwest, one of them being in the Navajo Nation, mm-hmm. which is pretty cool.
That's very cool.
Yeah. So we're actually later today, I have to be on a call with the Institutional Review Board of the Navajo Nation to keep working on getting all that set up. But the global market for this is enormous. We just did a study showing in the Middle East, and we used Jordan as a beachhead market. There's already adoption of desalination for agriculture mm-hmm. because it's water stressed and they need fresh water for agriculture. And so some farmers are already buying their own reverse osmosis systems. And we're showing that with our solar powered electrodialysis system, we can cut the cost of the water by like 40%.
No kidding.
Yeah. Massive, massive cost savings. So between potable water for drinking and water for ag, we're seeing many, many, many global applications.
Have technology. You worked with water.org?
I know of it. I haven't worked with them, yeah. but I'm familiar with it.
No, I'm just curious. Yeah. A friend of mine's their thing.
One of the big funders in this is the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, which is part of the Department of the Interior. And so the Bureau of Reclamation looks after water resources in the country. Mm-hmm. And so they really pushed us to look at the American Southwest as another great market for this potentially. So we work a lot on drip irrigation. And the two areas that we've made a lot of contributions in is one, we design drip irrigation emitters, and we do this with Toro. Toro mm-hmm. is one of the big Toro makes lawn tractors. It's the same mm-hmm. Toro company. Mm-hmm. So they're a big leader in drip irrigation equipment. So what we've done is created drip emitters that are less than half the plastic volume of existing products. So that cuts your material cost by more than half for a mm-hmm. commodity product. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a big deal. And they run at about 65% less pressure than existing products. And what that means is you can lower your pumping pressure and thus lower your pumping power
sure.
and thus need smaller solar systems.
So what's the key there? Is it just smarter nozzle design?
So as far as we know, we're the first ones to figure out parametrically how the features inside the drip emitter affect the pressure flow relationships. Mm-hmm. So we've been able to optimize those flow features so we get the correct operating flow rate at a much lower pressure than other commercial products. Mm-hmm. But this power savings, you know, if you're cutting your pumping power by like half,
oh, of course,
which we've demonstrated in pilots in Jordan and Morocco, you know, that's a big energy savings for farmers. But if you want to go off grid, that can cut your overall system cost by about 40%.
Is there a path to a PV version of
we
the drip irrigation?
We are running those. There's variants running in different. We're starting up. We have done pilots in Jordan and Morocco of those variants, and then we're starting up new ones right now in Kenya, Jordan, and Morocco.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So we can do solar powered drip irrigation very cheaply. The other innovation area that we've done a lot of work in is the system design and control. And what's really neat is that we can do an end-to-end design and operation, design and optimization of a system, going from the hardware and its behavior to the crop performance. And in real time, our systems are always looking at the sun, seeing how much energy they're getting, tracking how much water the plants have gotten and need, and in real time can tune how much water the plants need day by day to maximize their productivity. When you do that over a year, you end up with pretty significant energy and water savings compared to just running at a set schedule of how much water you deliver every day. And so we're seeing that these solar-powered irrigation systems that we're designing are going to be in the ballpark of like 20% less cost than commercial products out there. So it's pretty cool. And we do all kinds of tricks, like using machine learning to forecast what the weather is. And then there's always this real-time optimizer running to figure out how much water to move. And the other cool trick about this, and this comes into the product design element, like we can't just be these like, you know, gizmologists in our lab creating these wonderful, you know, pieces of hardware. We have to realize that this hardware is used by actual farmers, by people. Mm-hmm. So in parallel, Georgia Van de Zandt, who you know very well, is a grad student in my group who's been testing how people would actually interact with this technology and use it and make sure they see value in it and would want to adopt it. And one of the cool insights that we've come up with is actually incorporating a person into the control system. So in many smaller farms, they're not going to want to run like a network of sensors and a network of actuated valves.
Sure.
And they already have a farmhand there. So instead, what we can do is have commands sent to them, turn this valve on at this time and run it for this amount of time, and turn it off and turn on this other valve. So we can still do our optimized control scheduling, but with a person in the loop. And the other big merit of this is it puts all the complicated computation up in the cloud. All that's being received is something on a smartphone.
Set of instructions.
Yeah, or a SIM card in our pump controller that's just saying, turn the pump on now and turn it off now. It's pretty cool.
That is cool.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about your vision for the future and what's next for Professor Winter.
Sure. So there's a few big things that I'm thinking about a lot these days. And one is we've run a research model in my group that I think has worked well in terms of trying to strategically use engineering science to make an impact in the real world and do it in disadvantaged developing world type settings. And my group will sometimes spend 2 years investigating a problem to understand what the problem is before diving into a solution. You know, most of research is focused on the diving into the solution part. But understanding what the problem is, where are there knowledge gaps that prevent the problem from being addressed, and what are the research questions behind those that motivate our research? That has been a powerful method that we've used. And so one thing I'm thinking about a lot is, could I scale that and scale it in a collaborative way where we spend a lot of time scouting around the world with boots on the ground, years at a time sometimes, understanding where are these opportunities to make a profound impact in the real world, where these problems are so difficult that they really need new knowledge created through research, and that the research gaps and the research questions align with expertise of my colleagues. Could we convene those groups of innovators together?
You are kind of talking about, it seems like, more of a consulting type of organization that could draw from resources as needed.
But a consulting organization that has, like, its most critical tool that it uses is research. A typical consulting organization is going to apply existing engineering theory in most cases. They're not going to take years to decades to advance knowledge in a way to solve a real problem necessarily.
It does depend, though, no? Like a Sarnoff or a Battelle versus, yeah, say, a continuum or a frog. Or
something. Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. If it's a national lab or something like that, sure. But this, I want to make sure that the core competency of this program is the research. Mm-hmm. And that's the core competency of MIT. That's our mm-hmm. best tool that we have to our advantage. And this is actually where I've seen a lot of international development programs kind of go awry, is that they become too applied and they look like a consulting house. Mm-hmm. And then the academic community is like, well, where's the knowledge creation? Where's the research? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And instead, I've been able to walk that line well in my group, where we never compromise intellectual merit of a project. We are just choosy about problems we take mm-hmm. on to find ones that need knowledge advancement. Mm-hmm. And I think we can do that in a larger scale program.
Because I've also seen the other side, where it's the actual conversion to a compelling application that fails.
I'd say that happens very, very regularly. And the analogy I make often is you end up playing darts blindfolded. Right. The typical model here is that you come up with an idea for a solution. You're a good enough pitch person to get somebody to fund it. You know, you create it, you try it. And then only after a few years, you may ask yourself, could I translate this to the real world? And I want to take an opposite approach, is say, what is the real world asking for? Mm-hmm. And then use that to drive the research. So we're more demand pull than tech push.
Well, even more than the tech push, though, which I agree is seldom successful, even if you have a market pull, having the expertise to effectively convert that into something real is also where I've seen many places kind of step on themselves.
And I think the biggest challenge there is actually the translation. Mm-hmm. How a company or a government entity may articulate a problem may not be in the same language that a researcher needs to hear to understand, okay, here's the research I need to do to address it. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a role that excites me a lot about playing that translator role, to distill from real world problems the research questions, mm-hmm. and then find that network of collaborators that can attack them.
And find the people who can make it real.
And ideally work with those people from the get-go. Mm-hmm. That's also integral to the model that we run in the group, is that we're always trying in all our projects to work with a market leader that already knows the market well, you know, that has like Toro in irrigation. They already make tons of
We talked for quite a while about other projects, adventures, and plans, but I wanted to hear about this automotive stuff. Amos gifted all episodes of Top Gear to Professor Hosoi, and we heard from Professor Rogers about the four-wheel drive Lego car. But did you know about Amos's race cars and other automotive collectibles? The multi-car garage and lifts? Or how about his The Mechanic YouTube channel? Yep, he's an incurable gearhead. Automotive work seems to be a little bit of a departure from your research field.
Yeah. I characterize myself as an equal opportunity gearhead. So I have done some fun automotive work. We had a great research project with Ferrari for many years. And that, you know, getting to go to Ferrari twice a year is like, you know, visiting automotive Mecca,
sure,
which is wonderful. And we've worked with Tata and Mahindra. So I've done a little bit of automotive stuff, but that's not the core of the research. But I would say, yeah, my big hobby, what I sink all my free time into, is car stuff, building cars, restoring cars.
And when did that start for you?
So that's funny. I wasn't the type of kid in high school wrenching on my own car. It really started when I did the semester abroad in New Zealand and bought my motorcycle, which is a BMW Boxer. You know, where it's a wonderful bike to work on because the cylinders are literally hanging out in space and you can get access to all of them. It was during that semester that I started realizing, hey, I should work on my own vehicles. And I started doing all the service work on that bike. And it was a great machine to learn on because you can access the valve so easily because they're right out in space and you adjust the valve lash and all that stuff. And that started building the confidence that I could work on vehicles mm-hmm. and not screw them up. And in grad school, I ended up getting in a pretty bad accident in that motorcycle and had a head injury that lasted a year and a half. And so on-road motorcycling was just done. And so I wanted to keep up that hobby somehow. And so I was able to buy an old 911, the 87 911 mm-hmm. convertible, which I still have. And with that car, I started gaining more confidence in working on cars. I pulled the engine. I changed the main crankshaft seal. I adjusted the valves, did a bunch of work on that car and really made it perfect. That car is still perfect. And so over the years, I've just kept building up that confidence, taking on bigger and bigger projects. And so the big recent one was I built a race car, a 1983 911 SC track car, where I totally rebuilt the engine from the ground up. It makes 44% more power than stock now. So I put in higher compression pistons, more aggressive cams. And the big upgrade was switching it to carburation instead of fuel injection. So you can just get more air and more fuel and make more power. But upgraded the suspension and the brakes and put in a roll cage and race seats and race harnesses. And I compete with that car in the One Lap of America race, which is a race where you do a lap of the central part of the country where you go to a different racetrack every day and race around it.
And you don't trailer the car.
No, you have to drive your race car anywhere from 400 to 600 miles to the next track the next day. So over a week, you end up doing about 3,600 miles of transit driving. Plus, you're at a racetrack every day, so it's a crazy war of attrition.
And it's not points to get to the next track faster, so it's not a cannonball run type of thing.
It actually evolved from the cannonball run. The guy who started the cannonball run, named Brock Yates, and who wrote the cannonball movie, actually ran the cannonball run for a number of years, but it got too dangerous. People, you know, on public roads screaming on the highways.
It's still done though.
It's still done, but it's not through an organized body anymore. And
we,
so
we had a student maybe 4 years ago do it. By
the way. Really?
Oh, yeah.
The time to do it was during the pandemic. The records fell during the pandemic because there was no traffic.
I could see that. No, this was done before the pandemic, and I won't disclose her name, but she's actually an engineer at SpaceX right now.
Oh, that's cool.
So the person who's designing our satellite fuel systems or whatever they're designing has a cannonball run heritage. Now, I assume you read Robert Persig's book, The Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
You know, I've tried to start it. I've tried to start a couple times. No, it's Zen in the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. And it was too much Zen and not enough motorcycle maintenance for me. So I didn't get through it.
All right.
I would have liked more motorcycle maintenance.
Just had to ask. The Australia trip reminded me of the book. For me, that's the thrill, is interacting with an older piece of equipment and just having it do its thing and kind of not nursing it along, but just kind of acknowledging it for what it is and what it's done, and just to have that relationship with it to keep it going.
Absolutely. Yeah, I want to say a few things about this, actually. So I refer to what you're talking about as mechanical sympathy. Mm. And I love that feeling that you know what the machine is doing. You know what it's telling you. And, you know, when you're working with a 40-year-old race car, there's a certain amount of fragility to it. So it's pushing it, but not over-pushing it. I love that feeling. And the best example of this, I guess, for other viewers to check out or listeners, is my favorite kids book that I read to my son all the time is Mike Mulligan and his steam shovel. Did you read that to your kids?
Oh, you bet.
I cry at the end. I've read it 40 times probably, and I still do. And so at the end of the story, steam shovels have become obsolete. He can't get work. He gets this one last job and finishes it, and the steam shovel can't be used anymore. And so somebody in the town says, hey, why don't we repurpose the steam shovel as the boiler in the new town hall and make Mulligan, the operator, the janitor? Mm. And the last picture of that book is showing Mike Mulligan in his rocking chair smoking his pipe next to his beloved Marianne, the steam shovel in the basement. And it's like, I'm choking up just visualizing it, because it's that devotion to the machine and that love of the machine and that bond. And I absolutely feel that.
I was looking for a tissue.
To the listeners, I'm not actually crying, but
it was close.
And I particularly love with cars the feeling of going on a journey in an adventure. I'd much prefer to like buy a car and do some crazy trip with it than just, you know, have a car. So like, you know, the 911 we shipped to Europe, to me now, that thing's like an old steamer trunk. We have a Land Rover Defender, and I shipped it to India. I lived with it in India, mm-hmm. and I almost died a lot driving it around India. It was so dangerous. But I've had so many insane adventures in that vehicle. Like that, whenever I'm driving it, it brings me back to all those crazy memories.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
I love it.
I want you to listen to a sound.
This is the Stump the Chump, isn't it?
And tell me what car it is.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Okay. Let's see how we do on this. It's a bit of an experiment here. You ready?
It sounds like an F1 car.
Okay.
But a more modern F1 car. It's a turbocharged F1 car, I think. It's not revving as high as the previous generation non-turbocharged cars did.
Okay, that's a Ferrari 458 GT2.
Oh, I feel like a chump. Yeah.
No, I think that was a fine answer.
Yeah, the F1 car is a bit more muffled. I should have known that.
Okay, here we go. We have another one for you.
That's a NASCAR. It's a big V8. It's like a big displacement V8 car. Is it a Shelby GT500?
It's not identified, actually. It's a BMW V8, though.
Oh, I got the big
You got the block, big block, yeah. V8. No, yeah. That's awesome. Okay, we've got two more. This one's interesting. This is idling.
It sounds old. Yeah, it sounds like a 60s race car with a really advanced cam or something.
Ah, okay, so maybe on the camming. That's something. It's a Mazda 767B. Four rotor, 13J.
Oh, yeah. Oh my God. A Wankel engine.
It's a Wankel. Is it? Yeah, it's 2600 cc.
Wow. It's a four rotor.
It's a four rotor. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. 630 horsepower at 8,500 RPM.
Yeah. It sounded like it had a pretty aggressive cam in it.
Yeah. Let's listen to that again.
Oh, it's hard to pick up that it's a Wankel engine because it sounds like a 60s like F1 car almost, right? Where you have a really aggressive cam and it can't idle worth a damn. It's all just for high power.
Okay, we've got one more left. Actually, if you get this one right, I'm taking you out to dinner.
Oh, it's like it's a single cylinder, like thumper engine, I think, right? Like a single cylinder.
Maybe I'll just owe you a lunch then.
What is it?
It's a single cylinder.
It's pretty good, right?
It's awesome. You did. Hey, yeah. That's an Atlantic one lunger from Nova Scotia.
Yeah, it sounds like a little like agricultural engine or, you know.
It's a marine engine. Unlike the Mazda 4 rotor, this engine is a 3 horsepower at 400 RPM.
I should have known the boat reference because it's you.
Yeah, I guess. Hey, that was terrific. Thank you so much.
You did okay.
You did fine.
Yeah, I couldn't. What was the first one again?
The Ferrari 458. That one kind of bummed you out.
I know, I should have gotten. Can I hear it again?
Yeah, sure.
Because I'll tell you what I should have picked up on. So where I made a mistake, it's definitely not turbocharged. You know, you can hear it's naturally aspirated. It would be hard to pick up if it was a road car or a race car. Mm. But it does sound like a Ferrari V8. Mm. It's not as high pitched as a V12 because a V12 you'll get more power strokes per revolution than a V8. And in a turbocharged car, it sounds a lot more kind of muted because the exhaust is going through the turbocharger. So I should have done better on that one.
You know what? I'm just hats off to you for getting any of those arguably close.
Thanks.
And the Atlantic one lunger is actually the most impressive of the four.
The Wankel engine is a curveball. I don't know what a Wankel sounds like.
Amos, thank you so much
for
coming.
This was fun.
You know, very generous of you. I love this teaching with you. I love, man, you know.
Me too.
So I look forward to many more. And thanks for coming in.
Thanks.
I want to thank Amos for chatting with us and all of you for listening. And I'm serious about the Lock the Quill Global Challenge. Email your mailing address to lockthequill@mit.edu, and each month we will send the listener farthest from MIT a sticker.
The farthest listener by June commencement will also get a t-shirt. It's all for the fun of it, folks. A shout out to our friend and colleague in New Zealand, Dr. Mark Jeanette, for the tip on Amos's PowerPoint animation skills. I'll see if we can find that presentation for all of you. And because Professor Doug Hart was mentioned in the context of waiting around in garbage and Dr. Dan Dorsch got thrown under the bus, it's only fair we get in touch with each of them sometime soon. Spring term starts in 3 weeks, and I know some of you seniors are looking for what's next. I hope you're keying into the message about the importance of your mentors and network. You'll be hearing from us next January 27th when I sit down with a Course 2 alumna who shares her story from a grad student to a designer at a leading design agency. There'll be some advice there as you approach Career Day next month. And in the meantime, Lauren leaves us with this tidbit.
I don't fall very often, but when I fall hard.
Have a wonderful weekend, everybody.